On March 22, 2024, Krasnogorsk, Russia, a city just outside of Moscow, faced a mass shooting that left 144 people dead, 551 people injured, and 95 people missing. Shortly after, the shooting was deemed a terrorist attack, with conflicting reports of responsibility continuing to where the associations of the assailants are still unknown. With conflicting reports and questions still unanswered, this brings us to question how we got here and where we may be heading next. From Seton Hall University, this is The Global Current, and I am your guest host, Bobby Kyle. With me today are two fellow Seton Hall students. Covering the domestic situation today is our analyst, Trisha Balian. Hey, Trish.
Hi.
And focusing on the international aspect today is Nadia Chernov. Hey, Nadia.
Hi.
So let's start with background information behind the attack. What happened in Russia exactly?
So basically, as you mentioned earlier, Bobby, March 22nd, 2024, in Krasnogorsk, Russia, there was a mass shooting, which has now been deemed a terrorist attack, in Krokus City Hall, which is a concert venue where fans were waiting for a Russian rock band to perform. So according to reports that have come out since the attack, four gunmen opened fire on the venue and carried out attacks with knives on people and then set fire to the venue as well. So there's also a degree of arson included in that. So, like you mentioned in the intro, 144 people were killed between the initial attack and later injuries in the hospital, and 551 people sustained significant injuries. As of March 28th, though, Russian authorities declared that there were still 95 people that are considered missing. So some of the statistics are still not fully complete in that sense. There's some people who are still unaccounted for. So while this has been the most recent and deadliest attack in recent years, this is not the first terrorist attack to take place in Russia during Putin's rule. Since 1999, there have been apartment bombings that have been traced back to the ethno-territorial unit of Russia known as Chechnya, which I'm sure we'll get into later, as well as a hostage crisis in a theater in 2002, in which over 100 of the hostages died, and then seizures of schools and public transportation, suicide bombings, which occurred most notably on two airplanes. So there's definitely been a significant history of domestic terrorism within Russia. So while this attack was definitely significant, it wasn't totally unknown to Russia. So kind of on the topic of responsibility and, you know, how that's been dealt with. So initially, President Vladimir Putin declared that there was Ukrainian involvement in the attack, claiming that the four gunmen who were arrested trying to flee the border to Ukraine, and that Ukraine was providing them, quote, a window into the country. So regarding this, it received very strong denial from Ukrainian officials who claimed they had no connection to the event and still do. Ukraine has also claimed that Putin's accusations have intentions of increasing Russian fervor to support the ongoing war. A lot of this does have to do with the tensions regarding the war going on right now between Russia and Ukraine. So despite Putin's initial turning the blame towards Ukraine, 2 days after the attack, the Islamic State took responsibility in this message released from the news agency Amaq. So ISIS-K is what specifically took responsibility for it, and this stands for ISIS Khorasan, which is an arm of the terrorist organization that's operating specifically within Afghanistan and the surrounding region. According to the National Security Council, the U.S. Assembly did share intelligence with Russia in early March regarding a plan of terrorist attack by ISIS, likely in Moscow. Regarding this, there were some steps taken to avoid terrorist attacks in other areas. I mean, the American embassy actually released a statement to all Americans traveling in Russia to basically say, like, avoid large crowds, avoid, like, crowded venues that could be, you know, subject to these attacks. So there were steps taken by at least the American embassy. It's still unclear what steps were taken by the Russian authorities. That's another kind of point of contention, this whole thing. But overall, it seems that the Russian authorities did not take that very seriously. Even so, days before the attack, Putin addressed this as, quote unquote, outright blackmail and an attempt to, quote, intimidate and destabilize our society, end quote. So kind of going back to what measures were taken, according to workers at the venue, they were made aware beforehand that there were possibilities of a terrorist attack occurring, and they were briefed on how to handle the event, but there wasn't really much beyond that, and that's been a big point of criticism, both from people within Russia and a lot of outside governments, regarding kind of how Putin and his government addressed this information that was given from the U.S. I'm sure we'll get into that later with the international view of all this. And even after ISIS claimed the attack, Putin has continued to suggest that the, quote, radical Islamists, still have ties to Ukraine. So there's definitely a lot going on, a lot on in terms of how Putin's responding to it, how other people are responding to it. So yeah, that's kind of an overview of what I have for you.
Yeah, thanks for that. And yeah, really good lead up, really good down low on the lead up to such a horrible attack. Turning to you, Nadia, what did the Kremlin know about this attack beforehand, would you say?
Yeah, so the United States has a duty to warn policy where the U.S. routinely shares information about possible terrorist attacks with foreign countries under this policy, but it is unusual to give information about specific targets to an adversary because it risks revealing how the U.S. obtains intelligence. The U.S. shared highly specific information about terrorism plots with Russian officials 2 weeks before the attack on Crocus Hall. On March 7th, the U.S. Embassy publicly announced it was, quote, monitoring reports that extremists have immediate plans to target large gatherings in Moscow to include concerts and, quote, advising U.S. citizens to, quote, avoid large gatherings over the next 48 hours, end quote. This information was shared with Russia, with Russian officials the day before. And in response to questions about the intelligence shared by the U.S., Sergei Naryushkin, who is the head of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, told Moscow reporters the U.S. information was, quote, too general and did not allow us to fully identify those who committed this terrible crime, end quote. He continues saying Russia took appropriate measures to prevent an attack. And then, as mentioned before, Putin also publicly dismissed the U.S. warnings 3 days before the March 22nd attack. Russia was alerted to it, but it was, again, up to them on how they wanted to take that information.
Yeah, and that's really good to know. Is this intelligence sharing normal between two countries, especially such adversaries like the U.S. and Russia?
Yeah, Russia did take U.S. warnings seriously this time around at first because the intelligence that the U.S. shared included an Islamic State plot to attack a synagogue in Moscow. The day after the information was received, it came out that Moscow authorities had prevented an attack on a synagogue. And Russia has accepted assistance from the U.S. in the past under the Trump administration, where information was shared that disrupted two terrorist attacks in St. Petersburg in both 2017 and 2019. There could be multiple reasons why Russia trusted U.S. intelligence under former President Trump. I mean, Putin and Trump did have a similar way of thinking when it came to certain issues like economics and like NATO. And currently, Putin and President Biden don't have as friendly as a relationship. So that might be a contributing factor.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. So going to the attack itself now, we know initially that Putin blamed Ukraine and that he held them responsible. Does he still hold them responsible? And who bears the most blame for this attack?
Yeah, so Putin and senior Russian leaders are still claiming that Kyiv was the one that hired the four terrorist operatives and made plans for them to escape to Ukraine after the attack was done. In response to these accusations, President Zelensky said Putin and others close to him are seeking to divert blame for Russia intelligence failing. And the U.S. also rejected Russia's claim about Ukraine being responsible for the attack because it has received intelligence that ISIS-K acted alone. And why Russia is focusing on Ukraine is because right now their biggest enemy is Kyiv, and Crocus Hall isn't enough for Russia to adjust their worldview and admit that they neglected the threat of the Islamic extremist.
Yeah, so you mentioned that obviously Zelensky's pushed back, but have we heard a very large response from the U.S. or any other Ukrainian allies as well?
Yeah, it's just the U.S. is the only one that's come out saying that they haven't, that there's no intelligence saying that Ukraine is the one that is responsible for the attack. There was a video, I think, released of the people that were arrested for the attack. And I think they did say that they were hired by Ukraine. But again, that is kind of sketchy coming from what appears to be their interrogation. There could be links to torture and a forced confession there.
Yeah, absolutely. So ISIS-K took responsibility for the attack, ultimately, even if Putin doesn't believe them. What is the motivation behind ISIS-K claiming responsibility? And what do we know more about them and their ties to Russia?
Yeah, so the Islamic State terrorist network has claimed responsibility for the attack, specifically the Afghan affiliate, ISIS-K. ISIS has released body cam footage from the attack to verify its claims. for terrorist organizations' attacks on dissident targets mobilize existing supporters and attract new ones to the terrorist organization. In the past 18 months, ISIS has made a concerted effort to recruit Central Asian militants through ISIS-K. Specifically, their recent recruits have seen a rise in Russian-speaking and Russian nationals so they can target Russia. The four men arrested for the attack on Krokosol are nationals of Tajikistan. And the goal of a terrorist attack is to seek to provoke a powerful repressive response from authorities that has an aim to escalate violence. Putin has played into that when he vowed to punish those, quote, behind the barbaric terrorist attack, end quote. And as I mentioned before, it does show in Russia's interrogation of the suspects, because when they were brought into court, there were signs of torture and like the bruising and puffiness of their faces. And there, it is likely that the Muslim minorities in Russia are likely to face repression in the aftermath of the recent terrorist attack.
Yeah, so with that, you mentioned ISIS-K and its involvement with the Taliban. Could you go a little more in depth on that and why exactly they just hate Russia so much?
Russia said on April 2nd it had important matters to discuss with Afghanistan's Taliban leaders and was working to remove the Taliban from the list of banned terrorist organizations, signaling support for the regime. Dmitry Peskov, which is the Kremlin spokesperson, said, quote, "This is a country that is next to us. One way or another, we have to communicate with them," end quote. And since 2021, with the Taliban taking over Afghanistan, ISIS-K has been repressed, as in 2016, 2017, the Taliban's military pressured and forced ISIS-K into eastern Afghanistan, where they extensively recruited Pakistani militants and fighters from dissatisfied local tribes. ISIS-K core members were from the Taliban, who for various reasons, such as like bloodthirstiness, like they were just fell out with the Taliban leader, Akhtar Manzoor, who the ISIS-K likely calculates that by souring the Taliban's relationship with Russia and Afghan's neighbors, it can augment Afghanistan's economy, economic woes, and reduce financial flows to the Taliban, destabilizing its rule. And ISIS-K also likely hopes that by inducing the Taliban's regional isolation, it can grow more powerful on the battlefield and prevail in ensuing an Afghan civil war, which Russia and regional actors want to avoid above all else. There is a history of the Taliban killing ISIS-K commanders in like August of 2021, when ISIS-K attacked the Kabul airport. The Taliban did retaliate, most likely eliminating ISIS-K's deputy commander and other heads of ISIS-K. And then the Taliban did pledge to prevent international attacks from Afghan soil, which continues to be discredited as international attacks continue to be carried out by ISIS-K. And ISIS-K may complicate Russia's relations with Afghanistan, but it's not going to alter it fundamentally. And because of this, ISIS-K external operations have increased in the past 2 years as prospects of conquesting more of Afghanistan have diminished. ISIS external operations and attacks against international targets in Afghanistan seek to demonstrate its perseverance despite the Taliban's military actions and undermine the Taliban's successful external engagements. ISIS-K is the only terrorist organization that the Taliban actively fights. And as for ISIS-K in Russia, ISIS-K has long looked at Russia as a key international villain and target. In their propaganda, ISIS views Moscow as part of a broader coalition of Christian or Western forces engaged in an existential 1,400-year-old battle against Islam. ISIS statements claiming responsibility for the attack in Krokosol boasted of, quote, killing Christians, end quote. And they don't like that Russia, like, counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. They have attacked the Russian embassy in Afghanistan in the past and in 2022. They also don't like Putin's support of Bashar Assad's Syrian regime and how they repress Muslims in Chechnya. And yeah, ISIS and Russia have never been good on any good terms. So, and there has been a history of hate between the two.
Yeah, so thank you for that. That was a really, really good overview of ISIS-K and their involvement with the Taliban, with Russia, and Russia's international aim. So turning to you, Trish, can you go over why, and we mentioned Chechnya, but can you go over Islam in Russia as a whole and more behind the targeting of Russia by ISIS-K?
Yeah, so The targeting of Russia by ISIS-K, I don't think really comes as a surprise for most people. Russia has had contention with jihadist organizations in the past. There's a long history there. You can look to that starting with the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, which lasted around a decade, which basically, you know, entailed military action and intervention taken by the Soviet Union to intervene during Afghanistan's civil war. And this was from 1979 to 1989. It was a very brutal war. There was lots of casualties, which harbored to a lot of resentment between Afghanistan towards the Soviet Union. Kind of skipping ahead, there's also two brutal wars between Russia and Chechnya, which is an ethno-territorial unit within Russia. But there's been Islamist separatists in that region who have invaded other ethno-territorial units around them and have had contentions with the Russian government. So twice the Russian Federation's government had to get involved, and they had like an actual on-the-ground war. The second war in Chechnya has been considered the most brutal, and again, a lot of resentment has been harbored between certain populations in Chechnya, between them and the Russian government. And also, most recently, back in 2015, there was escalation in Syria when the Russian Air Force was deployed over them. And following this, the Islamic State released a message in Russian threatening that blood would be spilt, and also suggested that Muslim rule would, quote unquote, return to areas of Russia. And so this kind of brings back in what you were asking initially, Bobby, about the history of Islam in Russia, which is pretty extensive. Islam is very prevalent. It's the extremely most prevalent religious minority in Russia. Obviously, Russia is officially Russian Orthodox, but as far as minorities go, Islam is the highest one, with around 14 million recorded Muslims within Russia, which makes Russia the country with the largest Islamic population in all of Europe. So this is primarily centered around the ethno-territorial units within Russia, known as the North Caucasus. This includes Chechnya, which is 95% Muslim, Dagestan, which is 83%, and Ingushetia, which is 96%. So you can definitely see there's extremely high levels of Islam in those areas, pretty much the entirety. So in those areas specifically, it is the majority, even though throughout the entire Russian Federation, it's still considered a religious minority. As far as relations between the North Caucasus and the Russian Federation on a whole, there's been a lot of contention there. It's really important to kind of look into that and kind of like why. And there's a big path between that. Like I mentioned earlier, main thing there is the two wars between Chechnya and the Russian Federation that was overall regarding issues of independence, that Chechnya was, you know, trying to become independent from Russia and become its own country as opposed to just an autonomous region within Russia. And it was also invading surrounding territories, which obviously the Russian Federation wanted to take, you know, steps to limit, which didn't go over very well with the radical people who were taking part in the invasions. However, the North Caucasus still remain extremely dependent on Moscow in terms of economic subsidies and security. Their entire economy is essentially tied to the subsidies that's given to them from the Russian Federation. There's not much they can do on their own. However, despite this, you know, kind of forced dependency, there are separationist ideas that have remained a point of contention. That's kind of the biggest issue between the Russian Federation and the North Caucasus, is how to balance, you know, making people dependent on you to a certain degree without so much dependency that they feel like trapped and want to continue those isolationist and separatist ideas. And following this attack, the Kremlin did launch some counterterrorism operations within Dagestan, which I mentioned earlier, through the FSB, where they arrested four more men, which were allegedly connected to the Crocus City Hall attack.
Yeah, so obviously an uneasy coexistence between Chechnya, Russia, and Islam in Russia. Now, moving on to the impact of the attack, this is for either of you. What do you think is the long-term impact of such a horrendous terrorist attack on Russia, specifically on Russia's international relations and its domestic influence with Putin?
I can take that first, kind of talk about some stuff domestically. So despite the explicit acknowledgement of responsibility for ISIS on the attacks, Putin is still very vehemently blamed the shooting on, quote unquote, those who are fighting Russia with the hands of the Kyiv regime. So that essentially means that Putin has been claiming that Russia is the target of terrorist attacks by Islamic fundamentalists and that Russia is a country that demonstrates a unique example of interconfessional harmony and unity and interreligious and interethnic unity. That's the facade that, you know, Putin's trying to push, which is kind of in direct contention with what is happening with this attack and what's been happening in the North Caucasus, like I was mentioning earlier. And so his statements have been really done for two main reasons, which is to divert blame and to increase support for the ongoing war in Ukraine. So some experts at the International Center for Counterterrorism have stated that Putin is trying to avoid the idea that Russia's security is threatened by ISIS and that it's instead an act of terrorism as a military strategy from Ukraine. So it paints Russia in a better light in that sense, where if they're going to be the victim of an attack, they'd rather be the victim of a military attack versus like a true terrorist attack that really sheds some areas of doubt on their own like domestic security. And this is a quote coming from the expert. Putin tried to gain political momentum towards the war in Ukraine because he needs all available domestic help when it comes to supporting the war, which is extremely costly, not only for Ukraine, but also for Russia, end quote. This comes in conjunction with a new military recruit plan aimed at getting 150,000 more soldiers from Russia to go on the front lines with Ukraine. So all of this can just kind of lend itself to expected aggression increasing towards Ukraine between the fervor of, you know, rallying people behind this terrorist attack and, you know, increasing manpower on the front lines as well. I think it's also really important to note that this attack came in the same month that Putin secured a fifth term in office after elections in early March, after promising specifically to ensure Russia's safety and security. So he's definitely been scrambling in, you know, the face of this event. So this election very specifically had more eyes on it than usual in the ongoing war with Ukraine, because it's been a big, big point of contention between the Russian people and Putin as far as like ideals go and, you know, wanting to be involved in this war. Additionally, the death of Alexei Navalny reignited conversations regarding Russia's alleged free and fair election process and the history of the deaths of the opposition leaders. Maria Pievchik, which is a top associate of Navalny, stated that the Kremlin security agencies were, quote, too busy fighting politicians, activists, and journalists, so they didn't have time left to deal with terrorists, end quote, which is kind of lends itself to this bigger picture that, you know, Russia is trying to avoid, that their security can't, you know, handle, you know, counterterrorism, or that it's leaving itself vulnerable to terrorist attacks.
Yeah, going off what Trish said, and specifically with Russia and Ukraine in their war, this is not the first time Putin or other top Russian officials have equated Ukraine or the Kyiv regime to terrorists. Putin, in a meeting with top FSB officials, equated Ukraine to terrorists, calling them, quote, the neo-Nazi Kyiv regime has also switched to terrorist tactics, end quote. And in response to the recent terrorist attack, the foreign ministry said, quote, bearing this in mind, the Russian foreign minister issued a request to Ukraine's authorities for an immediate arrest and extradition of all those involved in terror attacks under the International Convention for the Suppression of Financing of Terror, end quote. And on Russia's list of individuals to extradite include the head of Ukraine's SBU security service, Vasyl Malyuk, for the October 8th, 2022 attack on the Crimean Bridge. And as Trish mentioned, Russia is currently increasing its military conscription. And its alleged evidence of Ukraine being behind the attack does fuel it. And with national unity being high after such a horrible attack, they are likely to see those numbers rise. And the sad thing is, with Russia putting blame on Ukraine, this could escalate the combat intensity in the current war, which is unfortunate because there are currently high expectations for peace talks between the two countries. Zelensky said recently for the first time that even without restoring the Ukrainian borders of 1991, they can start peace negotiations. And Putin has also been willing to conduct peace talks, but just the necessary conditions for peace talks are still lacking because both sides have different goals.
And just to continue adding on more domestically some of the issues that Putin's facing, which is kind of lending some more light as to why this has been so back and forth as far as blame and, you know, who's saying what and who's doing what. The attack itself is severely weakened Putin's self-projected image, which is the defender of Russia dedicated to, you know, ensuring security and safety. Like I mentioned before, there's like his campaign promises. And so a lot of criticism has come out because of the nature of the attack. It's made it seem that Russia's security, both domestically and internationally, is not as strong as Putin claims it to be. For example, the security footage of the venue shows the assailants of the attack freely entering the building, carrying out the attack, and then calmly exiting without resistance. In response to Putin's accusations, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky stated that Putin treats his citizens as, quote, expendables, not only regarding the recent attack, but in the past wars with Chechnya, and that also called Russia's domestic security into question, because it was all having to do with like domestic strife and, you know, contention and terrorism in that sense. Not only has there been an issue of Putin's image and what's going to come after that, there's also been a lot of outcry from human rights activists regarding the treatment of the detained men based on the appearances people have been seeing of them in court. During their court appearances, the three men that were arrested initially seemed to have severe bruising and cuts. One of them was in a wheelchair accompanied by medical personnel. Another had a plastic bag hanging from around his neck, and the other had a heavily bandaged ear, which a lot of people have taken as signs of torture. And like I mentioned earlier, Nadia was saying the forced confessions is, you know, a thing that people have really started to speculate about. And this has not come as a surprise, considering many Russian officials have called for severe punishment of the suspects, including former President Dmitry Medvedev, who urged the court to, quote, kill everybody involved, everyone, those who paid, those who sympathized, those who helped, kill them all, end quote. So very severe reactions. His was one of many from very high up officials in the Kremlin. And so this, plus the parading of abused suspects, is considered to be a tactic to maintain a tough facade that Putin has been trying to build, as well as to counter the criticisms of Russia's security not being able to prevent another attack. It's, you know, kind of like a look at us, look what we can do to the people who carried this out. We're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. Kind of a very like machismo sort of tactic in all of this. And that being said, human rights violations are definitely not new to Russia. They've been a subject of many accusations from both domestic and international groups. The Team Against Torture, which is an advocacy group specifically against police brutality, stated that, quote, if the government allows for torture of terrorism suspects, it may allow unlawful violence towards other citizens, too, end quote, which, you know, just kind of brings us back to this general theme that we've seen not only in this conversation, but in a lot of ones regarding the war in Ukraine and Russia, just in general of, you know, a discrepancy in how it's being portrayed by Putin versus what's actually happening and how a lot of the ideals don't match up.
Yeah, no, definitely. Russia's facing a lot right now. Putin's facing a lot. And this does not make it better for him on the international stage or on the domestic stage. Going to our final thoughts here, this is for either one of you. What knock-on effects, if any, do you think we'll see in regards to the war in Ukraine or for Putin domestically because of this?
I mean, I think we've covered it pretty holistically so far. But I think in general, you know, more fervor in terms of the war for Ukraine. Just in general, it's a very common occurrence that after some sort of terrorist attack where, you know, a country is a victim to something horrible like this, you do see a lot of, you know, kind of coming together and rallying of citizens. So I definitely think it's in the realm of possibility for that to increase and maybe change some people's perspectives on the war in Ukraine within Russia. And again, for Putin domestically, it's, you know, definitely a blow to his self-image. And I think any future policy he does beyond this is going to be very heavily scrutinized using this as like a reference.
Okay. And then finally, do you think this attack symbolizes a resurgence in ISIS-K or is it like a one-off?
I definitely think this, unfortunately, it was a very successful attack for ISIS-K. It brought them a lot of international attention, which is exactly what they want. They probably will get more recruits from this, and it's unfortunate, but this probably will lead them to possibly to do more international attacks. Other countries should look out and be forewarned. If like the US, if they share intelligence, other countries should take it seriously. And the Taliban hopefully will be able to pressure the ISIS-K more into retreating. And yeah, hopefully the Taliban will be able to keep ISIS-K in check.
Yeah, and hopefully international vigilance keeps them off our news briefings. This has been a great discussion, Trish, Nadia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
And that is all the time we have for today. Be sure to follow The Global Current on Instagram and LinkedIn for updates on upcoming shows. This show would not have been possible without our dedicated crew, associate producers Kasia Kostrava and Juliana Mori, show host Trisha Ballion, technical producers Ashley Sklodany and Amelia Wizichonsky, and of course, executive producer and your guest host, Bobby Kyle. The Global Current is brought to you by Seton Hall University. As always, keep it current with us and catch us on the waves every Sunday at 8:30 a.m. on 95 FM WSOU. Until next time, thank yous.